Good morning, Monica.
Good morning.
I'm Mark Schmidt. Welcome to Vlogging Heads. I'm Mark Schmidt, and I'm with New America and kind of a Vlogging Heads veteran. And Monica, why don't you introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Monica Potts. I'm a freelance writer. I'm a fellow with New America.
Great. And, you know, we're not exactly ideological antagonists. We are, you know, former colleagues at the American Prospect and current colleagues at New America. So we've had a lot of interaction over the last couple of years. I was particularly interested. I wanted to make sure we got you on Vlogging Heads because of, in part because of your article in the new issue of the Washington Monthly called "It's Their World, We're Just Renting It: Millennials in a Post-Ownership Society," which, you know, really was a magnificent piece. And I want to talk to you about a couple things in that piece and then talk a little bit about some of the student loan issues, which I think are really inseparable from it. And we're now, you know, way past the news cycle of, so far past the news cycle, I can't even remember the guy's name, Lee Siegel, who wrote the New York Times op-ed about why he didn't pay his student loans in the 1980s, which is actually a little laughable to me. But I want to talk about that if the world isn't completely sick of that. One thing about this piece is, you know, I've followed you as a writer for a long time, and you don't bring yourself into your writing very often, and that's been a particular strength, I think, of your writing about poverty and families in Baltimore and in Kentucky and elsewhere. You're not a heavy first person writer. There were many interesting things about this piece, but a little bit was your decision to write a bit about yourself. And I want to maybe say a little bit about why you decided to approach this question in part through your own experience.
Sure. I had been assigned to look at millennials in the sharing economy by the editors at Washington Monthly, and I was really excited about doing it because so much of what we were talking about in meetings really touched on my own life. You know,
right.
I'm 35, so I'm actually like a couple months older than millennials.
Right.
I'm just into Generation X by like 3 months, but I don't really.
I'm just kind of on the other end of Generation X, so you know, technically we're somewhere in the same something.
Yeah, that's right.
Again, proof that these generational categories can be pretty misleading.
That's right. That's what I was going to say. Like, it's really about who's around.
If you're in the same generation as me, something's wrong.
That's right. And I'm, because of the way my birthday fell, I was in classes with people a lot younger than me, you know, because I was one of the oldest people in my kindergarten. So that's just the way it works. And so I, you know, it struck me in the course of the writing, and it struck the editors too, who encouraged me to go down this way, that I just might have been the best character that I met who really wrapped everything up. Everything I wrote was true and true of a lot of people that I spoke to, but I was kind of partly, I think, because I knew myself the best, but also because the people who I met really touched on different aspects of what I was trying to say in different ways, but they didn't sum it up just as well as I did. And I think, you know, partly it was because that's where my reporting led me, and also just partly because that's what seemed that would serve the story best, was to have me in it.
Right.
I don't mind writing about myself. If it's a good way to serve the story.
Right. Well, I think it certainly worked well. And then, of course, you were writing about people you knew, and you were writing about them you're writing about them with some depth too. It wasn't just the, you know, insert random name of character and then a quote, but you were actually kind of getting deep into some other people's experience. I guess I was interested. I mean, It felt like your conclusions were quite bleak, and yet at the same time, as somebody who's a little older, I mean, I was sort of identifying with, you have a paragraph where you talk about people a good deal older than you who seem to have, you know, some pension savings and a house that they own and things like that that you don't know if you'll ever have. I mean, I'm more or less in that position, but I was. It left me wondering, it left me thinking back to when I was 35 or, you know, in my early 30s. I mean, was any of that certain for me at that time? And also being struck by how many things that are possible, you know, in the way you live and in the way that you use cars and the way that you're, you know, just the general mobility of your life, that's a pretty, that's not a bad thing. You know, it's possible to live this way in a way that it wasn't possible in, you know, the late 90s.
I think that's right. And, you know, I didn't mean to paint an entirely bleak picture. I think some of it's my personality, but also just some of it really is the fact that, I'm sorry, there's a fly bothering me, so I hope that doesn't mess up the video too much. So, you know, this is a companion to our conversation, right. But you know, I really do think that there are a lot of good things about life now. You know, I'm not entirely sure that I would have been a person who could have left Arkansas and lived entirely on the East Coast at an earlier time period. You know, I'm a woman, first of all, and it's not been very long that, like, a single woman could make a life like this in an urban setting anywhere, you know.
Right.
And so I appreciate what kind of the leaps and bounds forward we've made in just a few generations as a country, and I appreciate the possibilities that the internet have opened up. You know, I really, I can freelance, I could work anywhere, I have a much easier time tracking down the kinds of people I want to write about,
right,
than I might have in the past, and also all the sharing apps that I talk about, you know, some of them are really great. Like, everyone I spoke to my age loves Uber and loves Lyft, you know, they're just really...
Loves what? I'm sorry, what was the first thing you said? Everyone loves what?
Loves Uber and Lyft.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, you could just stand on a street corner and call a car to you. And also, even more basic than that, like, I don't think anybody ever gets lost anymore. We all have smartphones that tell us where we are and where to go. And, you know, it's really opens up possibilities in both trivial and non-trivial ways that I don't even think we can entirely list. But I did think that it might be time to kind of pause and think about where we're really going as a country. You know, I am not sure that people understand how expensive a city like Washington, D.C.
right,
is to live in,
right,
and how much more expensive it's gotten just in my adulthood.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when I was 22 and graduating from college, I could find an apartment in Park Slope in Brooklyn that I could share with people, and it didn't take up all of my money.
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
And I'm not sure that you can find
right.
That
I think that's a huge difference. And I had that too. I moved to New York right out of college, and I think, you know, for a while my rent was $250 a month. I actually had my own room, which was a former maid's room in an apartment. It was fine. You know, it felt like, and I knew people who were living on $5,000 a year. You know, they were somehow able to do that. But that was, you know, that was a very long time ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and just in my adulthood, it's changed dramatically.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's something that I sort of regard with an increasing sense of panic, because I don't know how people do it. I've partnered up, and I live with my boyfriend now, and together we have an income that's actually very respectable. You know, it's much higher than the median income, and
that's the thing to always remember. It's just crazy. I mean, I felt like, you know, when we moved from Brooklyn back to Washington 10 years ago, I felt like we were kind of priced out of Brooklyn in some sense. But, you know, there's no way we would have been, since we have an income that's significantly higher than the median income in Brooklyn. It's kind of a crazy thing to say. But in some ways,
right,
that doesn't make it any less real.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I also think it's something that these cities have to think about. They have to think about how they want to be composed. And so if, you know, a journalist and a social worker, or a journalist and, you know, however you and your wife describe your two careers, you know,
I'm also a journalist. I don't know what I am.
Yeah, that's right. you know, someone who works at a think tank, which is, you know, if it's too expensive to you to live in a city that used to pride itself on being a home for the creative class, like New York, then maybe New York is changing for the worse.
Right.
And
but Washington D.C. was never a place for the creative class, and it is much more so now than it was.
Mm-hmm.
Much more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, how quickly D.C. has gentrified is it feels way faster than Brooklyn.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, I was in Brooklyn for 5 years, and I was connected to it for 7 years. I lived outside of Brooklyn for 2 years, but kept coming back on the weekends. Lived really close. And that change felt very slow. Like, I could continue. I was kind of, like, slowly. And I think there are still places in Brooklyn you can afford to live, like Canarsie.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, D.C., it was like overnight. I found an apartment that was affordable 5.5 years ago. And within that time period, I was priced out of my own neighborhood.
That's right. And
all of the neighborhoods around me.
Right.
Neighborhoods that people, gentrifiers wouldn't have touched
right.
5 years ago.
Well, it was partly, it's purely crime. It's very heavily crime related. Like, you know, as soon as neighborhoods become safe, people, you know, they gentrify. And I feel like I saw this in the 90s. You saw neighborhoods start to, even Logan Circle or the areas just east of Logan Circle, you know, would start to gentrify. And then there would be just like a crazy little crime wave and it would kind of come undone. And then finally it all just really happened. And it has been very fast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And now there's a Whole Foods there.
Right.
And, and you know, I didn't want to make this, this piece sound like rich kids complaining, but I'm very much aware that people like me don't have it the worst,
right,
you know,
right.
But I think that it's something to think about, that people with degrees who should be doing the best in their generation are doing worse than generations before
right.
them.
Well, and there's just no, to me, the big variable is real, like if I think back to when I was 35, it was kind of the end of the time when I was working on Capitol Hill. I didn't know that I had any, you know, I hadn't made a lot of, that wasn't a high paying job by any means. And, I didn't know that I'd have any level of financial security, but I had gotten rid of my student loans. And my student loans were not, you know, I mean, I probably borrowed about as much as one could just for an undergraduate education. But they were done by the time I got into my 30s. And I think it's a huge variable that we don't fully appreciate, is just how different the magnitude is. And obviously different, you know, if you're also borrowing for graduate education, as you talk about. But it's just, you know, sometimes a difference of scale is a real difference of type. And I think that to me, when I read about your experience here, think about my own experience, that's the biggest variable. Like, how long does it take to get out of that particular kind of debt?
That's right. You know, I mean, the statistic I put in the piece, which is shocking, is that the costs of college have gone up 500%,
yeah. Yeah,
I think,
yeah.
in a generation. You know, and
you said in one,
so
you
that,
said
that
in one
that,
generation, so like from the mm-hmm. 80s to the somebody,
to today.
Yeah.
Seems
like a lot for
yeah, and,
20
um,
years, but it's probably over 30 years.
Yeah, I think so. That's right. And, you know, that difference means that everybody is borrowing,
right.
you know, because it's not just people who go to private colleges, you know, and I the decisions I made probably I would have had some college debt anyway. I went to a private school for college and I went to graduate school. But I also think that if we think about why people are going to graduate school, they're going to graduate school because the economy was bad when they were young adults. And also because, you know, the returns on a BA are still much higher than they still make a BA worth it.
Right.
But people are graduating with BAs and they're not in jobs that are fulfilling and pay well, and they don't see a ladder up,
right?
And so they're going to graduate school because they don't see the way to advance without
right.
it. And so the economic forces that drive them to graduate school and take on more debt are just as bleak as the fact that they have the
right,
debt, you
right,
know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so I think so that's part of it. And also, you know, if you're a young kid who's been successful in school up until the time you graduate from college, then the idea of going to graduate school makes perfect sense.
Right.
It's the way you've advanced your career up until then. And so
right.
It's really kids who go to graduate school are really the ones with the super high debt
right.
burdens, along with those who go to for-profits and those who graduate.
Right.
And you know, and even if people are just borrowing a little bit, then that's, you know, if maybe they finish paying off their loans by the time they're 30 or 35, that's still money that they're not saving, and that's still money they're not putting towards buying a house.
Well, right, but you know? Right, but if it's a very, I mean, it seems to me there is a legitimate basis for a student loan system as part of the overall education system. I mean, this is some of the backlash, some of the response, I think, to Lee Siegel, and I think this was true in Helene Olin's piece in Slate about it. You know, there's sort of I guess Helene was arguing, you know, that we tend to classify people as, you know, those sad victims of Corinthian colleges and things like that, people who borrowed money, got nothing of value, and are, you know, and really every penny they borrowed should be forgiven in one form or another because they're completely victimized. Helene was arguing, like, we're sort of creating one of those systems like the deserving and undeserving poor, you know, where so Corinthian College victims are deserving, yeah. And Lee Siegel, who's a jerk, is not deserving, which he's not. But that you don't get to pick, that basically the whole system is dragging people down. I'm not sure I go all that far. I mean, if there's a degree, whether it's a BA or a particular kind of graduate degree, where you really know the difference in my income from having this degree and not having this degree is going to be $50,000 a year or something like that. And some of these graduate degrees, that's true. You know, if you know that, then it's perfectly valid to borrow against that future earnings stream that's, you know, that is private, that is benefit, it is a benefit to you, and you're just going to, it's the same as, you know, borrow, you know, if you paint your house, you sell it for $50,000 more, well, if you need to borrow $20,000 to paint your house, you would, because it's a very, you know, it will be reflected in future income. So I'm not sure that all student loans are invalid. There's something about the scale of it. Obviously, people who borrow for programs they don't finish or that don't provide any benefit are tremendously victimized. It's interesting when people who are borrowing for, say, a master's degree that's not necessarily, the education isn't that great, but it is a credential that they need because jobs require it. The little
like social work.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what we see a lot of, is it's a slack labor market. So you're hiring, you put, you know, master's in public administration, master's in public policy required, master's in, you know, journalism is an interesting field where, you know, there are a lot of people who don't have those master's degrees at the same levels as some people who do, but sometimes it's a way of screening applicants is just to require the degree.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I mean, I agree with you that I don't think the idea of student loans is bad. Where I agree with Helene is just the scale. I mean, even if you look at doctors and lawyers who up to now at least have been really compensated for their advanced degrees and it's made sense for them financially, you know, I spoke to about a year ago for a different story. I spoke to a doctor whose dad had been a doctor, and she and her husband had both borrowed, I think they were in debt together, about $500,000 for their graduate school loans. And they're going to be well compensated. She's going to be a primary care physician, which means she can expect her salary to be around $200,000 a year. But, you know, you go through a long period of training to be a doctor during which you're not well compensated.
Right.
And so you have to start paying your student loans back when you're residents. And you're not well compensated then as well. And so she's 30 and she's still facing this massive debt. And she and her husband, I think they got an inheritance and they used that to pay down some of their loans. When you think about it, they're 30 and they have a kid together. It might have been better if they had been able to use that to find, you know, to buy a house and to think about their future. And so I think it's really the scale.
Right.
You know, they're going to be able to pay off their student loans.
Right.
But it's way more than her dad might have
used. Yeah.
And her dad was, you know, much better off,
right,
for not having had that, you know. And a lot of doctors go into specializations just because of the money, and I think some of it is driven by how high their education is.
Right, it's not just the greed of going into a specialty, it's that's what you need to produce.
Yeah, and that's where it makes the most financial sense to go. And I think, you know, I think it's just, you know, if it's a matter of borrowing $20,000, of course, then it totally makes sense to get a BA. But, you know, and most people with BAs graduate with less than $10,000 of debt. That's true. But if you, you know, I think also we have to think about the class dimension of it as well. If you're a very low income student and you're going to a private college like Bryn Mawr, which is where I went, financial aid is part of your loans are part of your financial aid package. And so I certainly could have rejected the loan part of my financial aid, but I would have had to come up with that money elsewhere, which is money I didn't have.
Right.
And so, you know, borrowing the maximum amount that the government would let me borrow was right. part of the paper that I signed that accepted the grants. Right. And so, you know, it didn't feel like borrowing money. It felt like part
of In a way, you're better off than some students who, not being eligible for other aid, have to borrow anyway, and then also borrow private loans above a certain amount. So, you know, borrowing the max that's you know, you're in a way, you're still better off than students who didn't have as much of a financial aid package. But of course, all education, I mean, you know, my colleagues here often talk about it in terms of discounting. You know, financial aid is sort of a form of discounting. They're coming up with the offer to get the students they want to get. But I want to, you know, just add one other thing to that, to the point about, you know, your friends who are doctors, or the people you spoke to are doctors. I mean, the other thing they don't have is that freedom to say, you know what, I don't want to be a doctor anymore. You know, I want to be a aromatherapist or something like that. I mean, you really limit your ability to make later in life choices in the same way that you limit your ability. I mean, we're talking about gentrifying neighborhoods and Brooklyn and so forth. I mean, one of the things about that kind of expensive urban lifestyle is often you know, you can make it work, you can figure out how to buy a home, but you're really locked in at a certain financial level that really limits your other choices. And I feel like at the same time, you're writing about a world here where there are lots of different ways to structure your choices. You know, you could just sort of, including, you know, you can go be an Uber driver for a little while. It feels like a world where there's not as many, you know, the world that I entered as an adult, there were a lot of things, there were sort of high barriers to entry kind of job things, like, you know, if maybe you find a way to get a job as a journalist at a newspaper. And once you've crossed that barrier to entry, you're expecting a certain level of security, even though I think if you had any clue, you shouldn't be expecting that. But some people were. Now it feels to me like there are a lot of things you can do that, you know, starting some kind of, you know, you talk about the Etsy sellers, starting something that's your own business, starting writing and doing things like that, where you're not necessarily getting over this high hurdle, this high barrier to entry, but you also have no security once you've done it.
That's
right. But getting in a way, is easier.
That's right. That's right. And there are pluses and minuses to that, and I don't mean to think it's all bad, but I do wonder whether it's time to think about where our security should come from.
Right.
You know, maybe the union protected job at a newspaper, that's gone forever, and we're not going to have that kind of security anymore. But maybe some kind of security needs to replace as a good liberal, I have my ideas about where that should come from. But, you know, I think that that's really kind of what we're facing. You know, the people I spoke to for my story who are my age and younger, they really do want to feel some security, and they want the security to be able to take risks.
Yeah, right.
You know, they want to be able to start their own businesses.
Yeah.
And I think that that's how a lot of people think about it, you know, and maybe before, what the security was partly that it was just like not so expensive to live, that it was possible to save the 3 months you needed to pay your rent and other bills, to have that kind of cushion. But I don't really think, you know, I mean, rent is very expensive. Like, the things people are paying money for are just, like, way too expensive, and they prohibit that.
Yeah, the era of, like, you look at a movie now, like Slacker, you know, about young people living in Austin, Texas, and I think that movie's from 1992 or so, you know. You realize it all depends on basically rent being free. This whole creative class, stoner class culture, you know, where you're really relaxed about these things for years into your 20s depends on very low rent. But it raises the question of, like, what other, you know, one response to an article about yours is, you know, what's so important about Washington, D.C. or New York City? You know, live in Pittsburgh, live in Detroit, live in Binghamton, New York, which is where my parents are from. And especially because of the internet and other things, I mean, like, you can do a lot of the things you do if you wanted to live in, say, Pittsburgh, which is a super cool city.
Well, you know, I think there are a few responses to that, not the least of which is the fact that Austin and Denver and some of the other cities that people used to move to for affordability aren't that affordable anymore.
Right.
They're a little bit cheaper than Washington, D.C., but they're really not, they're really actually not that much cheaper. I actually looked into moving. And so, and they're getting more expensive too because other people have this idea.
Right.
My sister has lived in Denver since she graduated from college. She's 5 years younger than I am. And so she's definitely a millennial and her rent has more than doubled.
Yeah, right, right. I wasn't even thinking about Denver. I mean,
and that, yeah, yeah. But you know, it was one of those cities that, like, at this time was, like, named, you know, one of the best, most affordable cities to live in. And so, one, you know, people are wanting to live in cities everywhere, and so rent everywhere is going up. Two, there are costs to moving. You know, you have to say goodbye to your friends and, to some extent, your work connections. I can do a lot of the things that I do from anywhere, but I can't have coffee with an editor who wants to meet me.
Sure.
You know, if I live in, if I lived in, like, Fayetteville, Arkansas, which is a lovely little city.
Right.
And so, which has the benefit of being close to my mom.
Right.
So,
and it's a college town. It's
so
a,
there's
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a, yeah. But, you know, there are, you could also say that people want to live near where their next job might be.
Right.
So if you have been working in journalism, D.C. is a good place to stay just in case, you know, a good opportunity
right.
comes up and then you don't have to move again.
Yeah, right, right.
So I think, and also, you know, I like D.C. okay. I love New York, but I don't think I can live there again. But also, whether I move or not also has something to say about whether people like me move or not. And then those cities have to answer the questions of what they want to look like.
Right.
You know, that's the main thing. You know, there's not, people talk a lot about affordable housing, but there also isn't moderate rate housing
right.
anymore. There used to be a lot of tax credits to encourage developers to build different kinds of houses. And so you would see luxury condos and you would also see apartments.
You mean in New York or Washington or elsewhere?
Everywhere, you know, that there were places where you could find sort of middle class neighborhoods, which, you know, Park Slope used to be sort of more middle class in the 80s, maybe a little earlier. And there aren't middle class neighborhoods anymore either. And so people who might have been middle class are shoving into affordable neighborhoods, which is what gentrification is. And that displaces the poor people. And so the kind of the only new development is really luxury, you know, is really the high end because that's where the money is.
Right.
And so I think the question is whether cities just want to be gated communities for rich people.
Right.
Or whether they want to be kind of diverse and in all kinds of ways, which is what they have been before, which is what you would think people were paying for to live in them. You would think that people are paying to live in cities so that the people around them aren't all like them. And there's this beautiful kind of convergence of different cultures and different lifestyles. And,
right.
You know, I don't
but,
know.
Right.
That's why I like urban
right,
life.
Right,
that's
why I like urban life too. And there is an affordable, I mean, especially if you're on the boundary of gentrification, that's typically where you would find affordability, right? Not necessarily, I mean, I don't know
right.
what all the new development is. I mean, I know there's some new, a lot of new development up near where I live and up in, you know, Tenley, a lot more apartment development in neighborhoods that are otherwise, you know, largely relatively small. Single-family houses, sometimes attached houses. It does seem like there's a lot of development up there. They're not the gentrifying neighborhoods, but it seems like there's a lot. But I haven't really looked at the costs. But that's just D.C. I mean, it's I don't know. It's it is hard to find all the different kinds of housing. But as people move into cities, there should be some room to build.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think new development is great, but I think the mix of development is important as well.
Yeah.
You know, because what happens is the gentrification border just gets pushed out and pushed out and pushed out, and so you have people moving every year to follow the affordability. You know,
right.
Maybe not every year, but
right.
every 5 years.
Right.
You know, and you have more people moving into suburbs now because they're relatively affordable rent-wise.
Right.
And so.
Yeah.
You know, so it changes the nature of the cities.
Right.
And so I think that's a question for cities is whether that's
right.
what they,
I mean, there's,
that's what they mean.
There's no, happen. There's nothing, there's no way that I would want to go back to the DC of 1997.
Yeah.
Right. And there's just no, there's, you know, there's no tax base in that city. There's no, you know, yes, poor people live in different neighborhoods than they live in now. But other than that, there's just nothing to be said for DC of the mid-90s. School system. I mean, yeah. There are no schools that there were, you know, I mean, maybe there were one or two schools that people would send their kids to. People who had choices, let's say, would send their kids to. Now there's quite a few.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think what I'm kind of arguing a bit against is this, that there's kind of an implicit conversation among people that the answer to affordability is just to build more housing.
Right.
You know, that that development solves that problem, that if you remove the height restrictions in a city like DC and San Francisco and you approve development, then the extra supply will drive down the costs, as if, you know, markets were perfect and
right.
and people in them had all the information
right.
that they need to make
right.
choices, and as if you didn't need to subsidize income on different scales, which I just think you do. I think I don't think that there's an answer to a city that is mixed and diverse and neighborhoods that are mixed and diverse without sort of the government putting its thumb on the scale in some
right,
ways so that
right.
it's not just sky high
right.
prices.
Which can be like some of the, I mean, there's a whole element of New York that's still, you know, based on policies from like the 50s and 60s and things like, you know, the term Mitchell Llama housing, which I'm never sure exactly what it means. But there were a lot of things in New York City development that created pretty mixed middle class. I mean, New York City is the only place where middle class people actually live in basically public housing developments.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are the mixed developments like the Mitchell Llama, things like that. But it was very deliberate. And I think we're beginning to see, I think what we're seeing now is like the end of that era in New York, of those very deliberate efforts to create affordable housing. But DC still feels different.
That's right.
DC still feels like it has a long way to go in terms of developing and rebuilding neighborhoods and building greater density in lots of different kinds of neighborhoods. It does feel like there's a lot of room, and I don't know whether development will be as deliberate to make sure that it includes middle class housing or not, but feels a little different.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. I think it should be deliberate, and I'm not sure how deliberate it is right now. I remember a while ago, and I don't remember where I saw this, but I know that Matt Iglesias picked it up and blogged about it while he was still at Slate, but someone quoted someone in, I think, Anacostia or Congress Heights, you know, a neighborhood on the southeast quadrant of the city that's still very poor, and they were fixing her streetlights, and she was kind of saying, no, please don't fix my streetlights. The gentrifiers will come, basically, is what she said. And the idea was that basically the cities that are still affordable in DC are those where we don't provide services.
Right.
And so what you see is like sort of a lack of city services substituting for an affordability plan, you know? And I think that's pretty terrible and dire. And so I don't know how true it is that that's all that's going on, but
right.
it doesn't seem like there's a lot of thoughtfulness.
Right. Well, I mean, the thing, it's interesting if they are actually switching the street, if they are fixing the streetlights, despite what this woman wants, that's a good thing. And it's not
that's
like
right.
Congress Heights
is,
you know, it's pretty far from the boundary of gentrification.
Yeah, that's
know.
Right. But I think it just exposes
yeah.
her.
I mean, the improvement
of
basic
the improvement
in basic city services from the late 90s is staggering. It's hilarious. You know, I mean, when we lived here
yeah.
in the late 90s, I remember they did, you know, they would start recycling. And then they'd run out of money and they'd stop recycling. And it would happen for, you know, it'd be like 3 months on, 6 months off. So nobody actually ever really got in the habit of recycling, even though they were still spending a huge amount of money on it. And now that whole system is, now the only argument is, who is responsible for taking away the old recycling bins when they gave us the new recycling bins? You know,
that's
it's
right.
like first
Which
world problem.
No
you know, kind of,
because...
Yeah, it's a problem. Our old bin is still sitting out there, but it's sort of a first world problem. In a way, compared to what we're used to in D.C.
Yeah.
Well, anyway,
it's
an interesting, it's a fascinating piece, and I think you did a really good job of capturing it. Not necessarily at the level of, you know, the recent graduates' total despair of we're totally screwed and you old people screwed it up. Did you see that post about the gripes of Gen X? Last week, it's very funny. I'll send it to you, but I won't go into it completely. You can read it with your Gen X hat on, you know, it wasn't totally from that viewpoint of we're completely screwed. But, you know, from the viewpoint of you kind of got some things figured out, but there's still like a fragility and insecurity. Oh, I wanted to ask one thing went back to the student loan question for a while. Did you, I have an interest in this because years and years ago when I was working on the Hill, I got very involved in trying to get income contingent. We called them income contingent loans at the time. Now they're called, I think, income-based repayment. Some people call it income-sensitive mm-hmm. repayment. You were talking about that as a pretty, sounded like that was a pretty positive way for you to manage your loans and for other people you talk to.
I wouldn't be able to make payments on my loans otherwise, but the downside is that it means I'll never pay
right,
them off.
Right. I mean,
you know, that it extends their future to a very long
time. I mean, I've been interested in this, and some of the folks here at New America have been doing research about this too. It's like, as much as I always thought like income contingent is the way to go, and it gives you that buffer if you want to just like drop, you know, if your doctor friends want to just stop being doctors and do something else, there, you know, it gives you a little bit of an escape hatch, and it gives you an escape hatch if you want to go to the expensive private university but you want to be an artist and you have no idea what the prospects are for that kind of thing. For lots of things it has a lot of advantages, but I think we find you know, and I remember finding this even when I was working on the Hill, and even more recently, people don't always like it that much. They'd rather take a loan and say, okay, I want to know what's my payment and when am I done? You know, and the thing about income contingent repayment or income based repayment is you don't know for sure what your payment is going to be, and you don't know whether you're going to be done, and it may be forever or the 20 right. It's 20 years in the case of the kind of program you're on.
That's right. And then it's, and it makes it, to be honest, in many days all feel very pointless. I think the point at which a few years ago I realized my loans had actually grown over time, made me feel, you know, really disparaging about the whole thing. And so, I think people, and especially young people perhaps, are like ever hopeful for the future. And so I've just like always thought about a time in my near future where I'm going to be totally rich and be able to pay everything that I owe. And I, you know, I would like that. If I had money, I would pay off my loans. Like, I don't want to not pay them.
Right.
But I think that, I think there's a point at which maybe when you hit your early 30s that you start to realize the truth of everything, and that maybe that this is adulthood, that this is what it
is. This is what
it
is.
You're making a modest, respectable income, and this is probably it for the rest of your life. And so I think when you hit that point, that income-based repayment seems like a really bad deal, because, you know, if I make on-time payments forever, they're going to be forgiven at some point. And I think that the question is, why make people borrow in the first place, right? If we're so prepared to not force them to pay and to write it off at the end, then maybe the system where people borrow such huge amounts of money isn't
right. I mean, we have to put some limit on it. I mean, the big thing is, like, even with the income based repayment, if you think of life as having sort of blocks, you know, you have a block that is your education and then starting to work, paying for your education, starting to get the benefits of the education, then you have a block where you're thinking about home ownership, maybe having kids of your own, those kinds of costs, and then you have a block where you're actually thinking about you're paying for your kids' education, and then you're thinking about retirement somewhere out there. You know, the main thing is that first block is just bleeding into all the others. You know, it's mm-hmm. just hanging.
Yeah,
that first block is not going away when you're in the home ownership, family, and even the paying for your own education block of life. And that's the big difference that income contingent doesn't fix at all.
That's right. I think that's right. And I think that that's where Lee Siegel's a jerk, and he was probably wrong and a liar about some things. But I think that's where his argument resonated with some people, because at some point, if you're struggling that hard to make your loans and income-based repayment is not making it much better for you, then you know, then I think at some point you're just kind of like, what is the point of this? Maybe it makes most sense to take the huge hit on my credit now.
Right.
If you're really struggling that much, there's a good chance your wages are being garnished for something already anyway.
Right.
And so, you know, it removes the kind of the bad part of what a default would be. And that has a lot of consequences for the way the system runs. And I think that's I think that's the big thing.
Right. Well, Lee Siegel is not somebody who had giant millennial student loans into his adulthood.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, older than I am. Loans should have, he just chose not to pay his loans and, you know, and he's giving people pretty bad financial advice. You know, there are a lot of things one could get away with in the 1980s, you know. I mean, nobody,
right,
for example,
right,
nobody did credit checks on employment. You know, when you got a job, now, if you apply for a job, people want to do a credit check. Nobody did that in the 1980s. They didn't do any of that. They couldn't even Google you. You know, you could get away with it was a sloppier time. And that makes that pretty bad advice. Anyway, it's a great article. I guess I want to talk a little bit about the Hillary announcement this weekend at Four Freedoms Park on Roosevelt Island, which, you know, despite having worked for several years at the Roosevelt Institute, which for a time basically that, you know, managed that, the construction of that Four Freedoms Park, which opened a couple of years ago. But despite that, I'd never been out there until I didn't go to the Hillary announcement, but a few weeks earlier I was out there. It's a beautiful, beautiful spot. And, you know, it seemed like a pretty well-handled moment. But I think what struck me the most was, you know, Hillary Clinton uses issues and policy more solidly than most politicians. You know, I mean, Obama had his issues and policies, but he also had a whole sort of vision around them and a vision about himself and things like that, that the policies were just a little bit of piece of. And Bill, too. I mean, Hillary Clinton is that was a very policy-heavy speech. That, you know, it's not just about her. It's really about a very carefully articulated agenda. I don't know. Is that your sense?
From what I've kind of gathered up in the ether about both her campaign so far and also in her speech. Yeah. But I wanted to ask you, do you think some of this is, I wonder if some of it is because she doesn't really have to talk about herself. Everybody knows who she is and they've seen her for a long time. And she's kind of just part of America.
I think that. And that's one reason why I'm kind of confident about her as a candidate. Like, she is what she is. She's not going to get sort of destroyed like John Kerry did, because most people didn't really know who John Kerry was in 2004. Mm-hmm. No, I think there's a, you know, there's the good, there's the bad, whatever. I think that's right. But if you look at her career, it's always been about fairly complicated, sometimes kind of technocratic. I mean, you know, in a way that can be dangerous is with the Clinton administration health care plan. But you look at the children's programs that she focused on in Arkansas, which you probably have a better feel for than I do. And then you look at some of the things that are in that book, It Takes a Village, and that whole approach. It's always been very, it's always been very much about issues. And then you think about, you know, some of the profiles that have talked about the role of Heather Boucher from the Washington Center for Equitable Growth, and John Podesta, who ran CAP, and Neera Tanden, who runs CAP now, and some of the other, you know, I've never seen somebody who was as kind of dialed in to the think tank world as Hillary Clinton is. I mean, you know, Amory Slaughter here in New America was director of policy planning at the State Department under Hillary Clinton, knows a lot of her people quite well. You have Neera at CAP, you have, you know, Strobe Talbott over at the Brookings Institution, president of the Brookings Institution, like an old friend of, you know, college era friend of Hillary and Bill Clinton's. I mean, there's just, you know, she's just like wired into this world and has drawn on really some of the more creative work that's out there, particularly on the economy, work from Roosevelt Institute and from Washington Center for Equitable Growth in a really, I think a really impressive way.
Yeah, and my sense is that that's really going to work for her.
Yeah.
You know, that because to the extent that those think tanks are dialed into the actual problems actual people are having and how
why am I doubts about that?
I actually think that's right, because, you know, one of the things that you hear from people across the board is how much that they're struggling, and they're not you know, they're not thinking about the 1%. They're thinking about how poorly they're doing compared to how poorly they were doing 10 years ago, or how well they were doing 10 years ago and how well their parents did at this age, you know. And I think that to the extent that what a lot of those think tanks are worried about doing is making life better for the actual middle class, you know, I think that this will really work well for her because people want to hear ideas about how to make their life better. Right. You know?
I mean, my biggest worry is that we actually don't have very good ideas. You know, I mean, I think we have the beginnings of some ideas, and I think we can talk about kind of what we were talking about before too, like ways of providing security that aren't as dependent on your employer providing security, that kind of next social contract concept, things like minimum wage, child care, family leave. Those are really important. They're not necessarily all the things that you would really need to do to, say, bring an economy up to full employment. And lots of things become easier when you have an economy at close to full employment.
That's right. But I think that as far, like something like childcare, if you look at who the working class is now and how much of it is composed of single working mothers, then I think that something like childcare feels like a silver bullet solution to a mom who can't afford to keep her kids in daycare, you know? And so, and I think that, I think we think about the economy in lots of different ways. And one of the ways that we haven't always thought about it really well is how expensive it is to live in America, if that makes sense. Like, you know, we've thought a lot, you know, and so I think one of the things that you could do to make people feel better about the way the economy is doing is just make it less expensive to live. And that includes things like, you know, childcare and childcare is a good solution because it could be expanded through the public school system, which, except for cities where it's being really torn apart and it's a huge political issue, I think that there's a lot of support for the school down the street that I went to and I'm sending my kids to.
Right.
You know, if I'm a kid, you know, if I'm a person in just a small town small city.
I mean, you still need to build the capacity. You know, it's not just a matter of throwing in the tax subsidy or whatever. I mean, you still have the classic dilemma with childcare, right? Which is that you need to increase capacity and quality at the same time that you're meeting demand or that you're making the cost.
And I've thought for a while that I think the childcare subsidy program that was expanded through TANF and welfare reform, I think that's a good program. It's woefully underfunded, and I've kind of thought for a long time that, like, also that giving people subsidies to pay for things is not how they like to do it. I think they would rather have a sort of a program for 1-, 2-, and 3-year-olds attached to the kindergarten at their local school.
Right.
You know, something like that, where just at a certain point, you just drop your kids off, and that's where they go
for the rest of their time. But that's a big, I think that's right. And
that's a
big investment. It's a big investment in physical space and things like that. I mean, I think it is probably the right way to go. It's probably, that might be closer to the French model. I'm not sure. What's the term for those French facilities? For children, there's some French. It's not like a pretentious French term because it's actually what they do in France. But there's some word for it. I think that would be, you know, we don't even have universal kindergarten yet everywhere in the country.
I know.
So it's like universal kindergarten, pre-K, 3-year-olds, and then what can you do for younger kids? I think that is a good vision, and yeah, it's always awkward when you're just throwing, whether it's through the tax system or a direct subsidy, where we're just continually hoping that the private sector will produce this thing and then throwing subsidies at it without the intervention to actually make sure that this thing gets created and made available.
And then it's always a rear guard fight to make sure it keeps getting funded and to keep you know, like the subsidies that people, low-income people get, they're always going to be under attack. And so it just doesn't work as well as like a universal system. But, you know, but I think that the notes Hillary's striking right now are the right ones for the people she needs to convince. Yeah. Like, she needs to hold on to the Obama coalition, and that includes, you know, unmarried white women.
Right.
And unmarried women across the board.
Right.
So,
right.
a lot of whom have children and stuff like that. And so it's interesting to me because it's interesting to me that she's talking about the economy in this way, which I think is much more, you know, this is going to sound weird, but she's just much more a woman this time. You know, in 2008, she just wanted to pretend like she wasn't a woman the whole race and until the end. And I think that that was really off-putting for people my age and younger, is that this, you know, here was this potentially like earth-shattering candidate and she never wanted to talk about it. She just wanted to be tough and hawkish all the time.
You mean in 2012? In 2008?
2008, yeah. Really, until the end, she didn't make a speech about breaking the glass ceiling until the end, until she was leaving the race.
I don't think I really got that. I mean, it's a long time ago.
That's how it felt.
Yeah.
It was a long time ago, but, you know, but like...
It's a way of talking about the economy that isn't, I mean, implicit sometimes in the way a lot of liberals talk about the economy is the idea of, like, you know, the male worker being able to support a family. Like, I think you can find that language even in, like, Clinton 92, putting people first, that idea that, you know, a single male worker should be able to support a family. Well, that's not the world we live in. On a whole bunch of different levels, and it does feel like the Clinton economic message kind of recognizes and respects that. It doesn't solve all that problem. I mean, like, it would be nice to live in a world where it doesn't have to be the male worker at all, but it would be nice to live in a world where there are enough jobs that and costs are low enough that one income could basically support a family and somebody, and, you know, but that's not where we are.
It's not. And you're right. I think a lot of people, when they talk about voters and when they talk about the working class, you can just kind of see the white man with a hard hat that they're thinking of. And there's something about that, the undercurrent of which I think has just always been off-putting to the younger Democratic voters.
Right.
You know, and so I think that that's why you see fights all the time about people who are like, how do Democrats get the white working class back? And underneath that, I think people my age, it feels like people are saying, well, how do we get the race?
Yeah, that's right. No, there's no
the
question about that.
Do you know?
Yeah, there's still a feeling like people are still like refighting stuff that happened in the 1970s when, you know, working
that's
class
right.
white
yeah.
men in particular. Did abandon the Democratic Party, and then other elements moved in. I mean, it became a much more suburban party. You look at, like, the kind of people elected in the class of 74. You know, it's a really fun fact. I was going to write this up, and instead of writing up, I'm just going to lay it out here. You know, if, you know, Martin O'Malley is a lifelong Democrat. Everybody else on the Democratic side who's running for president or thinking about running for president or talking about running for president or been talked about, including Elizabeth Warren, is a former Republican. Hillary Clinton was, you know, the chair of the Young Republicans at Wellesley. Jim Webb is a former Republican. Lincoln Chafee's obviously a former Republican from, you know, the most distinguished line of, you know, wealthy moderate Republicans. It's really a remarkable phenomenon how Sanders, of course, has never been a Democrat. But there is this sort of suburban Republican thread kind of moved into the Democratic Party. That includes, for example, pro-choice women, moved into the Democratic Party and in a sense displaced some of the white working class. And but for a lot of people, it's, you know, the idea of a Democratic Party that doesn't have at its heart, you know, that white working class manufacturing job male, even though that's a pretty small part of the population. The idea that you don't have that, it's just unsettling. It feels like it does feel a little racist because it's like saying this isn't quite real. This coalition isn't quite real unless we have that guy. And you know, it's shaky. It's dubious.
Yeah. And also the idea that, like, women and people of color and gays and lesbians will somehow fracture.
Yeah.
It's like something, you know, if something, but yeah, it really is. And I think that for some people, it just feels like, oh, well, you just let it go already. Yeah. And also because, you know, I think it's like, Ohio, Obama won Ohio and
Right.
Pennsylvania, which are the kind of the aging Rust Belt states that where we think of that guy the most, you know. And so I think that I think to some extent it might be a fight over racists in the American South.
I mean,
we don't vote for the Democratic
Party
anymore.
It might be. I mean, at the same time, I mean, it will be fascinating to see if Hillary Clinton is able to pick up any. I mean, if Hillary Clinton had been the nominee in 2008, her map would have looked a little different, right? Like, she probably, you know, she wouldn't have won the states that Bill Clinton won, like Arkansas and West Virginia, but she would have done a little better, and I think she might have not done as well in, say, Colorado, which would have been a slightly different map. The question is, you know, 8 years later, are we left with just the Obama coalition, or does she have any ability to change that at all, or does it really matter? Like, because the Obama coalition is just fine for winning presidential
I think
election.
She might. I think she might pick up some working class white women somewhere in some places. You know, I keep my ear to the ground in Arkansas, which is where I'm from, and I go back a lot, working on something there, and I talk to my mom, you know, who I think of as like a typical Arkansan voter in some ways, even though she's very liberal, but typical in how uninformed she is about DC politics, which is very, you know,
I think we have a high standard.
But she knows people who would think about voting for Hillary, who voted for Romney, voted for McCain, you know, that the people who we think that the South is lost, but I think what happened in the South is a lot more complicated than what people know. That some of it is about Obama and hatred of Obama, and that's why the Republicans took hold, but some of it is just that the Republicans just had a better ground for a while. You know, because the Democrats were resting on their laurels for many years, and they were just letting the sons and daughters of Democratic leaders flow into the party without doing a lot of recruitment. You know, and so I think there are a lot of sort of people who would vote Democrat for the right candidate.
Right. I mean, but the question is that just an Arkansas thing because people have known Hillary Clinton for 30 years now, or is it something?
Yeah.
Or is it something that would also be true in Tennessee, places like that? Who knows? It's like the most. It's not like essential, and I think she knows it's not essential. It's just an interesting little factoid to see whether that changes at all, because, you know, it's not a set, you know, I mean, in a way, I mean, also in this Washington Monthly, there was the article by Stan Greenberg that is basically about winning white working class voters, which I did a response to, but partly I didn't feel like a huge distinction there between white working class voters and other voters who might vote for Democrats. You know, or white working class voters who might vote Democratic versus other. I mean, because there are plenty who just won't. Those who do are basically responding to some of the same issues, like childcare, that we assume Latino voters and African American voters are responding to. It doesn't feel like a massively different issue agenda at this point.
I think that's right. I think that if Democratic candidates go after the working class, they'll get some of the white working class. Like, I think if you're thinking about the things that moms need to put food on the table and balance their checkbooks, then there's, you know, white women for whom that message is going to be appealing, and perhaps the men attached to them will also think it's as appealing. And so I think that if the Democratic Party can distinguish itself, which we haven't talked a lot about Mike Huckabee, but I think Mike Huckabee is kind of going after that vote a little bit too, in some regard. You know, the populists on the right, there's a strain of, you know, there are the strain of the working farmer populists who don't want the government messing with them, but also understand the way the market's rigged against them.
Right, but it's very hard to have I think the problem with that is, on the one hand, yes, there is that Huckabee constituency, and they don't like the way the market's rigged against them, but their distrust of government is so extreme that there's really very few answers that would be acceptable to them.
That's right.
I think the interesting part of Stan Greenberg's argument is basically saying that even for those who are receptive to the argument, which is to say they might vote for typically a Democrat who supports the stronger policies, the distrust of government is also really poisonous there. And unless we have some language that helps people get over that language, it doesn't really describe it well enough. Unless we're doing something about getting people over that distrust of government, then it's going to be really hard. You know, yeah, there's some people who are going to be pretty enthusiastic about supportive policies, but you got to reach people who are interested in supportive policies but don't really trust the government. And how do you do that? And people's distrust of government comes from lots of different places. Often it comes from just like seeing the legislature in action, not just that the services provided are bad.
Yeah.
They kind of overlap. So I think that, and there I think that, you know, I think that Hillary's message, which relies very heavily on Citizens United and get the plutocrats out and get all this money out and amend the Constitution if necessary, I don't think that does anything to give people, I mean, A, I think it's bad policy, but B, I don't think that gives any people anything to grasp onto to say, okay, government can be a lot more effective and I'll trust it to take care of my child care, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you don't think so? You don't think that the message, I mean, because people hate the moneyed interest, you know, and so you don't think that that's animating?
I think it's animating the base. I mean, definitely animates the base. It's definitely a fundraising tactic. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but you're basically saying to people, if at some point, you know, at some point in the future, maybe we'll do this thing called amending the Constitution, which we don't really do very often, and then that we'll get those bad guys out. It doesn't feel to me like you're talking about anything realistic that's actually going to change who has power in this country. I mean, maybe I'm being too literal about constitutional amendments. I mean, maybe I am. It definitely has some mobilizing effect. I think that's probably more on the base than on the that swing that needs to hear something different about government. But it's clearly a tested line. So I mean, I criticize it at my own risk because I'm not, you know, I don't have an alternative that I've focus group tested or whatever. But I mean, she clearly knows what she's talking about. She clearly knows why she's talking about constitutional amendment and getting the big money out. The question is, I don't know whether it's clear whether she's just talking to the base or to, or thinks she's talking to the broader public.
Yeah. What do you think drives the distrust of government? Because I've been trying to figure this out myself, because on the one hand, I kind of know from talking to people for a living that they don't pay very much attention to what happens in D.C. at all. And that, like, the arcane rules of Congress are not something that they, like, understand and follow.
Right.
And so who is exactly at fault and for they, what is right. not a
and
thing
they
that,
should. Right.
you know, yeah, and they shouldn't. And, like, why would they know?
Right.
I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think you see you either see huge conflict, and people don't like conflict, millennials don't like conflict, you see this zone of conflict and ugliness, and you think that whatever's produced by that has to be kind of ugly, messy, or corrupt. So that's like the first hurdle for the Affordable Care Act is really, you don't really need to know much, but there were certain things that had a much higher level of recognition than you would imagine, like the thing about the Cornhusker kickback, you remember that? Thing that was supposed to, you know, at the time, that was remarkably well known. So there were things about the process of healthcare that have basically burned the program ever since. You know, it's not like people don't, it's not like people hate the program because it's a crazy liberal lefty democratic solution, because it could have been a complete, could have been a bipartisan solution in a minute. They hate it because it feels like it came out of some conflict and that's sort of dubious. So I think that's a really big part of it. I think there obviously, you know, when you do something like screwuphealthcare.gov, again, it puts you a little further down in the hole. When when you deal with an entire party whose main message becomes we can't trust government to do anything, as opposed to the Republican Party. You know, the Republican Party, when I worked on the Hill, was kind of like, we'd love to see a slightly more market-driven approach to this problem. And you have a little less market-driven approach to this problem, so let's figure something out. That's not where we are now. Where, you know, even major problems and issues become, you know, things that we think the government shouldn't even touch, like health or education.
Yeah.
And it's hard to get around that.
It is, and they get so much mileage out of saying, like, the government can never do anything right, and then getting themselves elected to government and making sure that the government's not going to do anything
right.
And so, like, and I guess what is surprising to me somehow is that people don't see that manipulation happening.
Right.
You know, I'm not a partisan, and I don't, you know, I am not involved in, like, helping the Democratic Party get elected, and I'm often as mad at Democrats as I am at Republicans, but the extent to which Republicans are just, like, sabotaging the game for their own gain is really disheartening to me, you know, to see people elected to that body of, you know, to the House of Representatives or to the Senate just with the sole purpose of not doing anything there. It's just, like...
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's just really gross to me. It just is, like, fundamentally dishonest and, you know, almost un-American. Yeah. Like, I feel like you should do the things that you believe in.
Well, the idea, I mean, the most amazing thing in the last few years to me has been the number of congressional offices that said, we're not going to help constituents if they have problems with the Affordable Care Act. You know, it's a screwed up program. It's their problem if they can't figure it out. I mean, that's, you know, coming from a... You know, the period where members of Congress secured their seats by really intense constituent service. That's kind of unbelievable that you would do that. But it's true. But it's a very subtle point. I mean, it's a hard thing to persuade people of. It's hard to really believe that people operate that way. And I think what people are seeing is what I think you and I see as a lot of conflict in Washington that's sort of in bad faith. The Republicans kind of operating in bad faith. I think a lot of people assume good faith, and they just see nasty conflict, and probably don't want anything to do with it. I'm not sure why.
I think that's
right. I'm not sure why we do. Anyway.
Oh yeah.
So here we are, Washington D.C. Everything costs too much. Student loans are killing us. Nothing but conflict. And yet.
It's terrible.
And yet it's all right.
Yeah, and yet we're here. We are. Yeah, right. I know.
Let's wrap up. We've been talking for 64 minutes, so let's wrap up on that. Thank you, Monica.
Sounds good. It sounds like a nice diary.
Okay, nice to reconnect with you, and I'm looking forward to your next article.
Okay. Great, thanks so much.